Okay, I'm reading a Department of Defense Intelligence Information confidential document, Directive 01 on preparations for an imminent ceasefire agreement issued by COSVIN and the peace agreement announced by the North Vietnamese government, dated 24 November 1972. François Lange has given this to me, and it contains his analysis. The report contains information obtained from enemy documents. It concerns two records maintained by an unidentified individual, possibly a member of the 2BN Subregion Party Committee, pertaining to the study of Directive 1 issued by COSVIN, which concerns VCNVA preparations for the imminent ceasefire agreement and the eight peace terms of the North Vietnamese government. The attached is on analysis, and it is really fascinating. And I'm going to move to one particular part of it right now. I'm turning the page. On is written, the basic objectives: we must kill tyrants, break the enemy's oppressive control, and liberate hamlets. Principal slogans used: we must adopt the slogans peace, independence, democracy, social welfare, and national accord. Cities, efforts should be focused on liberating RVNAF subsectors and RVN towns. The goals of the revolution, this is a quote, we should partially initiate revolts in each area before initiating the liberation of the rural areas. We should contain minor objectives and major ones if the enemy fails to observe the ceasefire agreement. We must stage an all-out armed revolt to seize the governing power. However, there is little chance the enemy will violate the ceasefire agreement. On writes in the column, please see mistake, wrong assessment by the communists. Then there's also some Vietnamese that I can't understand. Our objectives are to stage political struggles to seize power, or conduct political struggles demanding social reform if possible. Concerning the peoples who left North Vietnam to live in the South in 1954, penetrate our personnel into the area and develop our agents. The political task that goes on then writes, there's one area where each cadre would be equipped with a loudspeaker, a military process line slogan. After securing RVN areas, guerrillas should construct fortifications and recruit more personnel. He then writes he types, we realize we had gained the greatest victory and the U.S. suffered a serious humiliating defeat. And on writes in the side, this will be emphasized by the VC. And this report goes on and on. He has a notation on important objectives. To achieve the objectives of the U.S. Vietnamization plan and negotiation on a strong position, the U.S. has escalated, prolonged, and expanded its aggressive war in Vietnam, thus blocking the progress of the peace negotiation in Paris. During the past 4 years, especially at the beginning of spring of 1972, the resolute and indomitable Vietnamese people have intensified their just struggles in military, political, diplomatic fields. That goes on and on. He writes, the most important initiative of the communist campaign, this is the breakthrough in the Paris negotiations, involved the proposal advocated by the DRV. Government calls for an end to the war throughout Vietnam, a ceasefire in South, an end of all U.S. military activities. He underlines, there will be two administrations in South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, the so-called PRG, which will have their own rights in setting internal and foreign affairs. These two administrations will negotiate with each other to carry out South Vietnam people's right to self-determination, national concord, and democratic rights. On writes, VC agreed to implement the Woodrow Wilson Doctrine for South Vietnam, which is to carry out South Vietnam's people's right to self-determination, national concord, and democratic rights. A notation on this, On is doing this for Time magazine, trying to explain it to him. Thus, the Vietnam issue will be settled in two steps, as long expected by the U.S. Government. Two administrations. On writes in the margin of one, this will take years to come. The end of the war and the restoration of peace will create conditions for the establishment of new, equal, and fruitful relations between the U.S. and Vietnam, North Vietnam. The U.S. will contribute to the reconstruction of North Vietnam and all Indochina countries. And that Ahn's report is based upon the directives that he has received here in another document, which is titled Headquarters, United States Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, Office of Director of Intelligence, Combined Document Exploitation Center, APO, U.S. Forces 96222, dated 18 December 1972. That's a captured enemy document, bulletin number 50904, subject directive of activities to perform during the ceasefire, Long Ahn Province, and he's got things marked here, predicting that is soon. Anyway, he's lying down right now, and as I look at this, this is Ahn's work.
Zip Grant's letter was utter trash.
So. Right, and that's something I was going to ask you in a little while. So let me there's a lot I want to just really ask you about Ahn, and also I want to ask you about the Time Bureau and your time in Vietnam what I'm writing is a full-scale biography of Ahn's life, but I'm using Ahn's life really and his role as a spy in Vietnam, but also. As a window on the war and all the complexities.
Right.
It wasn't just that you didn't know. It was the Vietnamese didn't know. Right. And he was able to...
Yeah.
And then I want to come back to your famous quote about that you're not angry at him, you know, and all that. And
keep this in context, when the war ended, there were 35,000 Viet Cong apparatchiks or spies or whatever you want to call them in the Vietnamese government. 35,000. So even if Ahn had been a conventional spy, he wouldn't have been anything. You know, it was part of a huge whole. And that was another point that never came through in the article. The article marked the sound more or less as though Ahn was doing this on his own all alone. Oh, Lord, no, it was...
I can't find the...
That's okay, honey, thank you.
Did you file it by chance?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
I probably filed it somewhere. And that, missing on that point, the other point was that Ahn was very proud of the fact that he never warped his journalism, never once. And I know he didn't. Well, and you can be cynical about that if you want to, and say that the reason he didn't, he knew he would have been caught. I think it was John Ahn, you know, when he went to Fullerton State, learned some journalistic principles of which he was very proud.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think he took great pride in the fact that being a journalist and being a spy required the same analytical ability, and he was able to compartmentalize in a way that I think most people could never be able to do.
Right.
I mean, that's what's extraordinary about him.
Exactly.
That he could separate these things.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm going to shut up, Larry, and let you do what you need here, rather than not just.
Let me ask you. Do you recall the first? You hired them.
Mm-hmm.
You hired a lot of good people,
and
that's been covered in a lot of articles.
Yeah.
I read the Columbia Journalism Review article about you, and since I'm not writing a book about you, I can say you have a great life. It's fascinating, and so many people hold you in such high esteem. But do you recall the first time? Just tell me about how you hired Ahn. Did you meet him? What was your first impression of him? And then just talk a little about what, as a journalist and you as a bureau chief, what you saw in him that allowed him to become so successful in both his career as journalism, but also how that might have reflected.
My faint memory, it is a faint memory, that Bob Chaplin introduced. Stanford brought him around.
Okay.
And Hahn's cover story was superb. He didn't tell us, but this became common knowledge that he had come from a wealthy landed family in the Delta whose lands had been taken away by the Viet Cong, and that he was eternally bitter about that. That's the reason he was quiet and reclusive and didn't have much on frequent occasions, I have to say. But what I saw in him was just the quiet intelligence. And secondly, he obviously knew far more about the ever-changing Vietnamese political scene than any of us did. And that was extremely valuable, because when you covered South Vietnam in those days, political coverage was almost as important as war coverage, because, you know, the prime ministers came and went pretty fast. And so that was the reason that those are the two reasons, the two basic reasons I hired him. And he lived up to every expectation I had. He was as good as I thought he would be. And I would really like to be able to take these old Vietnam files, which don't exist anymore, but the old Vietnam files, and take from on everything that on ever filed at the time and have it analyzed now. I bet you will not find, I'd be perfectly willing to bet any odds, you will not find one case of the warping of the journalism.
You know that you may recall this, that Arnold de Borjov, indeed, and Senator Jeremiah Denton, and former POW and Senator from Alabama, Jeremiah Denton, they both actually had a congressional committee do that, to prove the premise, in their opinion, which was unproven, that Times reporting during the war was biased by a communist spy, and they could find no evidence in anything Arnold did.
That's Arnold.
They could find no evidence in any story that he contributed to of any bias or
any plan. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. So it's been done.
It's been done.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, because they were so sure they would be able to find it. Yeah.
Well, the Borscht would still believe it.
Yeah.
That wouldn't change his mind much.
That's exactly true.
that was
you didn't follow Vietnam files up in some of those file cabinets up in the closet?
No, I mean, that's all business records.
Okay. Where else might they be? I have some things in here, but I don't think...
No, I don't think you took them in there, honey.
I'll take a look.
I should have her work for me. This is good. She's not going to give up. All right, so that's an important point about. Now, do you recall on disappearing for days and no. So it was never you didn't see him daily or anything like that. Because he would disappear for these days where he would using the cover of having animals dropping off stories. And
To be very truthful, I simply don't remember that.
Okay. Do you remember his dog?
Yes, sure. Yeah, because he used to bring the dog to work every now and then. That's a wonderful story about Arnold. That delights me.
Did you know, were you, I don't know if this is the time, if you overlapped, but did you overlap with Sam Anson,
Robert, right. Yeah.
He worked for me.
He worked for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he worked beyond that. After I left Vietnam, and then he worked for Simmons Ventures.
Was it under your when he was working for you? Was that the time that he disappeared?
No.
Okay.
That was after I left.
That was after you left.
Yeah, it was when he working for Ventures.
Okay.
There's no doubt Ahn got him released.
Right, and Ahn has told me the full story of that. From the first, Ahn is, even the New Yorker article did not have it right.
Yeah.
And Ahn has given me all the details of what happened and why.
Yeah. And of course, there was a lot of suspicion of Bob that he was a lefty and that he arranged his, simply arranged his being taken in the when he got tired of it, left.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I have,
yeah,
I've never heard that.
Oh, that was a divorce cross.
That he had arranged his own abduction.
Yeah, just because he was friendly with the folks anyway. And then, of course, left whenever he wanted to.
So, when I was talking to you about Ahn just a few minutes ago, you were describing his qualities as a journalist and the like. And so, I want to just jump ahead to something because I'm just thinking about it right now, which is when Ahn, in 1975, during the evacuation, Ahn and Ahn's family and certainly so many people in this country all immediately raised your name for the role that you played in raising money and helping his son and his wife get resettled here. Can you tell me a little about that?
Well, I guess I was still writing back and forth with Ron then, but in any event, I knew that his son made desperately, a little too strong, strongly wanted an American education. And so, I thought that was a worthy project. And the first thing we found was at the University of North Carolina, there was a sizable Vietnamese community of students. And that would be a sensible place for him to go. And so I just got in touch with, you know, all the old friends of Ahn, and we raised $32,000, I think it was, to bring him over from Vietnam, to get him into the University of North Carolina, and be put up there by a friendly American family who liked Vietnamese. And attached only one condition to the help was that if we did this help, he had to guarantee to go home. Because he would have been, obviously, he would have been a prize for any American journalism, for any publication in the United States. You know, the Vietnamese with the background he had and everything. But I didn't see any point in that. And so the condition was that he'd have to go home, and he did. Then 2 years. 2 years after that, I think 2 years after that, he returned on his own and went to Duke this time, and got his law degree. A remarkable young man, very, very bright. And,
did you stay in touch with him while he was in the... Now, Ahn told me that the home that he stayed in North Carolina was actually the mother-in-law of Bob Anson's wife at the time. It was his mother-in-law.
Yeah. I don't remember that.
Okay.
Certainly possible.
Did you stay in touch with young Ahn when he was an undergraduate?
Yeah. Just in terms of, you know, he's doing all right, is everything okay, do you need any help of any kind, that kind of in touch. And he'd call and tell us how he was doing.
Would you gentlemen like a cup of coffee?
Yeah, honey.
No, I'm okay, thanks.
No, I don't think I will either.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm already hyper enough. So, and were you in San Francisco then, or Sacramento?
Sacramento.
Okay. That's another interesting story about Ahn, which
yeah.
is that he knew Eleanor McClatchy.
Yeah,
yeah,
he sure did.
And he had gone up.
I didn't find what I was looking for, but I found all those pictures they were looking for one day.
I didn't ask you if you have any pictures of you and Ahn anywhere, or you and
let's see.
I thought you had one of Ahn. That's why I went through all
yeah.
of them. There isn't one.
He's a hard person to find pictures of with other people sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that was
clever.
Now, did you also work with Germaine during this period?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I spent a lot of time with her.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, matter of fact, I hired Germaine as sort of a special, she did specialty reporting. You know, she'd been a paratrooper nurse.
Yeah.
And so she still had remarkably good contacts inside the Vietnamese military. And she was under deep suspicion by the CIA that she was. And one day the room was blown right out of the caravel, and the Danner hung it on her. But in any event, yes.
That's interesting. She's hinted at that to me, and she and her husband, Dick Swanson.
Son Dick Swanson.
Who you know.
Yeah, he worked for me.
Great photographer.
Yes, he is.
And they've been both very helpful to me.
He worked for me for 5 years, 4 years.
And I think, you know who else David Burnett is the other person who I spent some time with in Washington,
yeah.
who also, I think, worked for time for
yeah.
a while as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Another fantastic
yeah.
photographer.
Yeah. That was a pretty talented bunch of people went through there in those years. And
so what I was going to ask you about, my next question, which is, why don't you talk to me about those people who went through there? Who, you know, your recollections of each, of whoever
yeah.
you want to talk about, you know?
Let's see, where would I start? Start with Bob Anson. Anson was sent out from New York, and chief of correspondence then was Dick Clerman. He was a dear friend of mine, and he said he was sending out for the Saigon Bureau quite the brightest young journalist he'd ever known. And he knew that I would find him so too. And Anson was a superb journalist. Very fast, very accurate, had a great nose for stories, and of course immediately acquired the reputation of being leftist. The way he did, the reason he got that was at one point, I've forgotten what the briefing was, the point came up, somebody was criticizing the savage Viet Cong, and Anson said mildly, well, you know, this is their country. And, oh boy, that brought down the wrath of the gods. Okay, Anson, and then Karsten Prager, K-I-A-R-S-T-E-N-P-R-A-G-E-R, hired him from Associated Press in Bangkok. Because I just thought he did a superb job over there, brought him to Saigon, and he was just a great war correspondent. And then he subsequently became foreign editor of Time in New York, and you know, was lived up to everything that I thought he was. Larry Burroughs was the greatest war photographer, I think, of all time. Then there was the inimitable James Murdoch Gilliam McLean Wilde, Jim Wilde, who most people thought was wacky, but Jim was a good reporter, and Jim had lived in Southeast Asia and mostly in Vietnam for 18 years before the war started, so he had, you know, he had a background that. He was a little wacky, all right, but he was Bureau. And let's see, who were some of the other really good ones? Bill McWhorter, who is now, I think, dean of the journalism school at Missouri? Well, not Missouri. Northwestern? Maybe Northwestern. McWhorter was a really fine correspondent.
And you hired Tip Grant?
Yeah, I hired Tip from. Zip had been Army Intelligence, and when he finished his active duty, you know, he'd become a source. And so when he finished his active duty, he wanted to get into journalism, and I just kept him right there. Matter of fact, that's one point I make here. I said that he shares a distinction with Ahn. I hired him, too.
Yeah, Ahn remembers he and Grant going on a couple of trips together
the
tension always building between them.
As I say in here in this letter, Zip, if you had deep, lasting suspicions of Ahn, why didn't you tell one of your bureau chiefs? Wouldn't that have been a helpful thing to do?
That's in the letter.
Yeah.
That was
not published.
He refused. He refused to contribute, which is okay, to the college fund. But I mean, because
that could be. But I. Yeah, that's right. Although, as I remember, not this may be wrong. He pled for poverty, not ideology. But I'm not sure of that.
Now, I recently interviewed Bernard Kalb, and Bernie told me that one of his deep regrets was not contributing.
Yeah.
And he had no recollection as to why he didn't contribute, but he didn't. And he said he wished he could have changed his mind because he calls on Ahn all the time now. He sees Ahn on every trip to... And he goes, Bernie's there all the time.
Yeah.
And Bernie opened up to me on this. He just said, you know, it was one of the major regrets when you asked, or when whoever was asked, for some reason he declined. And he now, of all of the things in his life, that's one of the things.
Oh, it's beginning to come back now. And I think what his answer was when I called him, I don't think that's appropriate.
Yeah.
Something big like that.
Yeah.
It's beginning to ring little bells back here again. I would think logically Bernie would have been one of the contributors for sure. Let's see some more.
You arrived in 64, right?
Yeah, it's January of 64.
And, of course, in January of 64...
It was all advisory.
It was all advisory.
About 16,000 Americans in the country, all advisors. Small-scale war. There's only been... Ak-Bak, I think, was the only battle of more than a platoon size. Up to that point.
Now, I was going to ask you about Ak-Bak, so since we're there, let's talk about it. Which was you were not in Vietnam.
No, I was not.
But Ak-Bak, as you've learned about Ak-Bak now, what's your impression with respect to the role of the reporters and the credibility gap and the significance of Ak-Bak? Because Ahn got his first exploit medal for Ak-Bak. I'll tell you why later, but that was...
Yeah. This was the first, as I remember, this is the first circumstance in which the press corps said, no, that didn't happen. You know, here's what happened. And that was the departure point. As a matter of fact, the New Yorker, then or a little later, ran one, the Annals of War, and ran the Atbach battle in detail, and had it nailed. But again, in the United States, there was virtually no recognition of that, because it was still an advisory war at that time. And Americans were paying very, very little attention. Matter of fact, they were paying very little attention when I came back to the States in 68. I couldn't believe the disinterest in the Vietnam War in Washington.
Now, for you on the ground in Saigon, the difference in the press corps and the reporting of the war between 64 and 68 must have been phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
It went from just Halberstam, Sheehan, and a few other people there
to 800 people.
800 people.
In the press corps. One of the points I made in answer to.
I look forward to reading.
Yeah, this guy was. Sure, I felt just as bad as you do about the 58,000 American dead. A lot of them were my friends, too. But what has that got to do with arm? You know, he didn't kill them. You know, the press corps took very, very heavy casualties in Vietnam. As I remember, there were... 250 dead. Now that's international press corps. But if the military had died at that rate, there would have been 200,000 or 300,000 dead. The press corps died at a higher rate, which is not surprising. We lost time of life. Lost 1, 2, 3, 4 dead. I don't know, we had a lot more. But I keep drifting off here.
No, that's all right. You know, for me, interviewing you is very intimidating as a reporter, because I should just ask you, what do you think all the questions I should be asking you are? Because, you know, you're the professional reporter. I'm just a professor here. So my last question to you is actually to tell me everything I should really be asking you, because you could probably interview yourself better than I could ever interview you. But
we're trying to concentrate on that.
Yeah.
So
you tell me what you want. What do I need to know about Ahn from you?
Yeah, the fundamental point that I think has been missed over and over and over again is that Ahn did not, in any circumstance, warp his reporting. We've gone over this, but it already had detail. But it bothers me so that people say, well, we knew that. We always knew the mainline press was. Leftist,
right?
About as leftist as Attila the Hun.
What about the irony of Ahn working for the Loose Empire? You know, that is because time was pro-war, and
there was a circumstance. You know, when Ahn was there alone from 75 through 76 or 77, and the reason that was done. Time kept the bureau open simply to maintain a presence. And I don't know how much Ahn really filed during those years. I don't know anything about it. I was gone from the company. Because I remember that's when Gart was wanting to murder Ahn.
he wanted to kill that son of a bitch,
yeah,
is what
yeah.
I said, but he then retracted some of that.
Well, all the high security people who were giving us information wouldn't talk anymore if they knew that time was full of communists.
Now, did you hang out with, did you hang out at Givral with everyone else too?
Yeah.
Or,
occasionally. No, I didn't really hang out there. None of us did.
Because that's where On would regularly.
Yeah, he would look at coffee.
Do you know his friend Jolene? Jolene, the wife of the wife of the Corsican who owned the very popular restaurant. His best friend in On's best friend.
Lamiral.
Yeah. And the woman who later married him.
Yeah.
Jolene de Orna.
Okay. That was everybody's favorite. You know, big expensive restaurant, La Mirale. And she very much ran it. But God, I'm glad that research was done. I can't tell you how that delights me.
Did you know Nick Turner?
Yeah.
Any impressions?
Well, yeah, I like Nick immensely, and he's a good journalist. Now, he says now, all these years later, that he was suspicious of him. But it's hard for me to...
On saved his life, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Saved Nick Turner's life.
Yeah.
When the husband of the woman he was screwing around with wanted to kill him.
Yeah, I know that. Nick now says that he was suspicious of Bond for a long time. Well, all of you guys who were suspicious of Bond for a long time, why didn't you do something about it? If you really had grounds to be suspicious.
Well, you know, the thing about On is, this is what Neil Sheehan told me, that, you know, we couldn't get anything out of any official sources, and therefore they lost control of us entirely. It was a good thing for us that every reporter had to go out and build his own intelligence system, and that's why we relied on On.
That's exactly right. What you could get from, particularly from the military, but also to only a slighter, lesser degree from the embassy, was generally worthless. It didn't bear on reality. And the thing that used to baffle me the most, I was never sure whether the people were deliberately lying or were just that misinformed. You know, you really believe that's what happened at at Oshawa or wherever? We know that. How do you know it? Well, that's what our people told us. Oh, I see. Yeah.
When you were, I think Lansdale came back in 64 or 65. Did you know Lansdale at all? Did you ever interact with him?
Yeah.
What were your impressions of Lansdale?
Well, I liked it a lot. And his friendly enemy, Lou Conin, was a good source, good friend and good source for a lot of us. I was with at dinner with Lou the night he tried to kill Lansdale. He was at the top of the Rex, on the top floor of the Rex, and Lou and I were at a table next to the railing to the outside, and I guess he spotted Lansdale coming up the street, walking up the street. He picked up a potted bomb and held it for a long time. dropped it in Miss Lansdale about that far.
I've never heard that story. I've been on top of the wrecks many times. And what was the reason that he hated Lansdale?
Well, he didn't really hate him.
And if he really hated him, he would have hit him.
He would have hit him, yeah. I mean, he was... Ed had come back, remember?
Yeah.
He'd come back to Lecoulin, which the Vietnamese said was some apprehension. Lecoulin was back. They were about half afraid of him. And I think what it did, what was happening, is that Lou was no longer the center of all attention. Lansdale was there. And I think that's what did it eventually. But I liked it. And incidentally, I think he did a wonderful job. He was a fine intelligence officer. And matter of fact, had the United States listened to him a little bit 5 years earlier, Ho Chi Minh could have been easily brought along. There was no doubt about it. He was ready. But Washington wasn't prepared to deal with anything like that. So, but...
Ahn believes that getting rid of Lansdale was the worst thing that could have ever happened for the Americans for the war, because Lansdale was the only person who could control the M.
Yeah.
And indeed...
Yep.
They got rid of Lansdale because, of course, the M was already making moves towards the neutral camp, et cetera,
and
the M had to go as well. But
Ahn,
to this day, believes that the whole American war could have been avoided had the M not been overthrown. And, of course, Konyan was the guy who did that.
Yeah.
The story that I'm telling through the eyes of Ahn, because Ahn was then also involved in the other coups after that, especially against Khan, and he was aware of the planning, and then Dr. Tien comes in at that stage, and Tien gets kicked out of the country and sent off to some post he never takes, and the like.
I trailed Khan constantly for what a remarkably ineffective little man.
Still is.
He was unbelievable.
Did you know Dr. Tien?
Yeah.
He had been at that time the head of ZM's secret police officially.
Yeah.
And then,
I'd say moderately well. He was not either a friend or a close source, but I knew him. Names are beginning to slide on me. Jim, I think it was the one who assigned or hired the one they called the Black One. I don't know whether he was Cambodian or Melanesian or what. The Black One to kill. The nationalist or communist, depending on what we want to believe, colonel. There's a big flap over that. And he was in the hospital. Saigon Hospital, and the Black One came in and strangled him, killed him in the hospital bed.
Oh, that's gone about this.
Oh, come on. No, in old age, I've evolved the theory that your mind is not going to hold on to anything it isn't going to use in the next 5 minutes.
Well, you're doing all right with me on this. So one thing I'm not clear on is when you came back in 1968, I know that, you know, I know what you did, but did you stay in touch, regular communication with Ahn as a reporter from time? In other words, was this, did you?
No.
No.
Did not.
No.
Because, but one thing, just terms of organization, I moved to life when I came back.
Okay.
In Washington.
Right.
And discovered that was a total disconnect from that world of hard news. You know, it just that isn't what you were there for. Although I did manage to do one very effective thing. I got the Killed in Action list for 1 week, 3 days early from the Pentagon, and then we all made arrangements with stringers and bureaus and everything all over the United States to be prepared to pick up pictures. And I think the KIA list was 312 or 340. We got all but about 9 pictures, and without comment, we just ran them like a yearbook, and said, this is this week's Killed in Action. These are the American kids that are out there. And Lyndon Johnson said that waging a war after that was impossible. That made it impossible for him.
That's right, and LBJ did not... I think highly, too highly of your effort at that.
Well, Lyndon and I didn't get along
yes.
too well.
You know, I've written a book called Lyndon Johnson's War, which.
Have you?
I've written 3 books on the war.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you one. I'm going to leave one for you. But one, the reason I brought this one out is my most recent, but it's called No Peace, No Honor: Nixon, Kissinger, and Betrayal in Vietnam. It's about the Paris Peace Accords, but it's about the time. After you left Vietnam,
yeah.
It begins in 68, because I thought it was appropriate that I not try to teach you anything about when you were there,
yeah.
But I'll leave you something from when you left.
Yeah, that's
so it was actually a conscious decision of mine, but on that.
But that had a massive public
yeah.
impact. And the reason I was inspired to do it was that I was so infuriated to find out, you know, the Americans were interested, particularly Washington. We were interested in the domestic fights over Vietnam, but they'd totally lost interest in Vietnam.
Right. Well, you know, the theme of my book, it really galls me today when young people say, my students, I'm a professor at the University of California, Davis, and when my students say to me, well, Vietnam, if we had only used our military power, we could have killed them, you know? And I point out to them that the United States committed 550,000 troops. We bombed the crap out of their country except for population centers. We defoliated their jungles. I said, and if you ever want to see something interesting, just go to Cameron Bay and just say to yourself, look at this logistical setup. Look what we gave the Soviets, first of all, originally, and then the Vietnamese. And how can you ever call that an undercommitment of resources? And then they always make the point, well, you know, we fought an enemy in pajamas. I said, we didn't fight an enemy in pajamas. We fought a military that had been hardened by all these. And the students, oh, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
And they don't get the analogy between this and Iraq. They just don't get it.
No.
And
but the, you know, this is 2 demonstrations in a row here. You cannot change cultures.
Right.
And if there's a loyalty to that culture, you're going to lose. You may not lose in a month, you may not lose in a year, but you're going to lose. And we're finding that out all over again in Iraq, to our great astonishment. You know, why don't they welcome us?
Well, you know, we didn't listen to Bernard Fall
in
Vietnam.
Yeah.
We didn't listen to Tom Friedman and other journalists who understood the culture back then. They could have told us all this. I wanted to ask you, did you know An has a great fondness? One of the things An has told me, the way to understand his life is to understand the role that he believes in luck and stars and astrology and the star he was born under and all this stuff, and his attachment to women, in particular, who he's always attached himself to. And in Saigon, for example, you know, he's given me a list of Western reporters and friends who I've been interviewing. And the one he admired the most as a reporter was Beverly Deep. Did you know her?
Yeah.
And what are your impressions of her? Or do you have any?
Not really.
Okay.
No.
Because he worked.
You know, the thing that was hard that relatively early day to accept was a woman in the combat zone. We were still, most of us, pretty old-fashioned about that, and always scared to death that you'd have the ill luck to be with one of them when you get caught in a bad spot, you know.
Right. Interesting. And she was a risk taker.
Yes, she was. You bet she was. Mm-hmm. She was a risk taker. She a good reporter. Beverly was a loner. She didn't run with any of the pack.
Okay.
And I admire that.
You know, we've mentioned his name several times, but talk to me a little about Bob Chaplin.
Well, I think of all the people who covered Southeast Asia, including Vietnam, over that 20 years, Chaplin is so far out in front, so superior to anyone else. He's truly in a class by himself. His intellectual and his instinctive understanding of Southeast Asia were immense, and he had and wrote, a deep sense of history, and understanding the cultures, and most of all, a clear understanding of how almost inescapably hostile Western presence was there.
And he relied on two Vietnamese streamers in particular, An and Vong, right?
And Vong.
Yeah. Talk to me a little about Vong.
Vong was born at the age of 9.
The first time I've heard that. Good.
He was a wrinkled, withered, old Vietnamese, obviously, out of his looks, if nothing else, very, very wise, and he was indeed, and enormously connected, politically, of the two, I'd say about a dead heat. They were both superb reporters, and yeah, Bob spotted Boone very quickly.
You smell my.
It's gonna help, Mom.
Huh?
It's gonna help.
I've got three dogs, so I'm sure yours just smells mine. Yeah, you got my three German shepherds. So Bob spotted Vong very well.
And Vong was invaluable to Bob. You know, what Vong did was, Bob certainly had a lot of other duties in Vietnam. When he'd be absent from Vietnam for 2 months or something, when he came back, Vong filled him in. You know, Vong gave him almost a presence that he couldn't have established any other way. And Bob used to say that insofar as his reporting about Vietnam is concerned, Vong deserved about 60% of the credit.
Stanley Carnot just told me that a Chaplin story, that Chaplin couldn't believe that An was a spy.
Right.
Couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
That it couldn't be, couldn't possibly,
yeah. Right.
It couldn't possibly be. And Stanley said that really struck him as surprising coming from a man like Chaplin. That
Well, I suppose this is semantics, but I think what Bob didn't sense is, you know, An was a pretty limited spy. He, once again, his role was simply to listen and report. He wasn't out to do active harm or assassinations or anything like that. And that's where I think Bob missed it.
Okay. That's a very important point, actually.
Yeah.
A point missed by a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the way you began today, which is the way I'm beginning in my own book, which is that Han was one of 35,000, 40,000, 50,000, and even the spy members of a network, okay?
Yeah.
And that
even
the Vietnamese, it wasn't the fact that the American reporters, like Halberstam or McCullough or anybody didn't know about Han. Germain didn't know.
No,
Bouziem, who I just spent 2 hours with, Bouziem didn't know. Bouziem would go to Bernard's and have lunch with him and never suspected.
No.
And it was, and so it's the nature of the war and the nature of the culture.
Exactly. Well, that's another reason that I'm suspicious of all those people who say, I knew all the time he was. Yeah, come on.
Right.
Why didn't you do something about it then?
I think I only had a few more things I wanted to ask you. One is, I made a note back here. Did you know Dick Steinman or Richard Steinman, who was the bureau chief for CBS or NBC at the time? Different media, but...
Yeah, it sounds familiar, but I don't remember.
Okay.
All
right. Because he knew Vuong very well, and he married a Vietnamese woman who one day, who you might have heard that story, someone was cleaning, a reporter was actually cleaning a rifle that he had picked up in the field, and a bullet just went off and hit her in the head.
Yeah, hit her in the head. I remember that.
Yeah. And that was his wife. Who, but he's just written a great book called Vietnam Television's First War. Which is very, 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 very good.
We used to call it that, too, out there. Who the hell was he? A long-time NBC correspondent there. We used to figure that he'd organized all the battles.
Remember these?
Yep.
I started collecting those. Did you give your papers to the University of Reno?
Yeah.
Nevada, or is it University of Reno?
University of Nevada, Reno.
Reno.
Yeah.
So your papers were up there.
All up
and
there.
Do you have your papers from then, your time in Saigon, are up there as well? In other words, if I went up there to
they'd be there.
To look at your papers.
And,
unless
somebody's done a lot of work on them in the usual total disorder that I keep things.
Like, well, the same way Chaplin's papers are and everyone else, which is good. So I think I'm going to definitely go up there. And, do you know, did you turn in, as part of your material, did you also have photographs and things like that? And
not many. I'll tell you what it was. It had a barrel like this, big barrel that we carried around with us for 25 years. And I'd get a hold of something and I'd think, you know, I ought to save that. So I'd just drop it in the barrel and put the top back on again. And we carried that barrel around for, the ones at the bottom had to be totally moldy.
So I will go up there because, you know, one of the things, well, you know this better than I would ever know it, but when you're doing, let's say reporting, but me writing a book, you go everywhere for clues, and who knows if somewhere in your papers, somewhere in your papers,
absolutely.
In 1965, you know, you've got something about Han in there that I'm going to just find as a treasure, and it's worth me going up there and finding out. Now, would it surprise you to know? I want to tell you what I've learned. I want your reaction to it. Not from you, but from Han.
Yeah.
Would it, twice, once in 1955, but then once in 1968, twice Han was actively recruited by the CIA to work for them because of how valuable. Does that surprise you at all?
No.
Or? No.
No.
That's how good his cover was.
Yeah.
The CIA was even trying
to
recruit him.
No, not. And, Moo Koneen totally trusted Don.
Right. I've been spending a lot of time with Koneen's wife, who's still doing really great down in Virginia. She remembers
still living down in Langley.
Not really. I've never met her at her home. I meet her in a restaurant.
Yeah.
She's right. But it must be close to Langley because they're in Virginia.
Lou was a delight.
He trusted on.
Yeah, he trusted on.
That's the first time I've heard. I mean, there's no reason I never asked that question.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
really important. Did you know Rufus Phillips? Who was who knew Conan very well. He was the
landlord. Shared dinner a couple of times, but no better than that.
Okay. Colby trusted on.
Colby trusted on.
I wish you would. Did you ever talk to Eleanor McClatchy about on at all?
No.
Yeah, too bad.
Never
that would
did.
Have been a.
Never did. No. Never occurred to me.
Right.
Eleanor was sailing pretty fast by the time I got there. All she wanted to make sure I understood is newspaper people never make news.
Mm-hmm.
They report it, but they don't make it. Yes, Eleanor, I got you.
Well, Anne's got a gift from her, a signed book and about the family, and he spent a lot of time in Sacramento
and
he had such fond memories.
She was a grand lady.
On that. And
now the company's so big. It's the fifth biggest newspaper company in the United States now.
Yeah. Did you know Marcus Huss?
Marcus?
Huss, H-U-S-S?
No.
Okay.
No.
I cut you off a little while ago when, which is not a good thing, on the story of the last days, I know you said you only had secondhand accounts primarily, but is there anything particularly important in that you think?
Well, Bob Chaplin's role in it was just monumental. Two-thirds of the, very large number of the Vietnamese who managed to escape never would have got out without Chaplin. He made the arrangements. For instance, how he did this, I'm not sure. But he made it possible for him to travel down, what the hell was the name of the road, the street out to Thompson, which had been cut off, obviously. It was roadblocks out there, and you couldn't get through. But Bob got people through. I doubt that anybody else could have done that.
And he had help from On.
He had help from On.
On that, and a few others.
Well, then help from the CIA,
right.
Which cleared the blocks for him. But a substantial number of people are alive today who wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for Chaplin.
Yeah. Now, here's my notes from my interview with On, where On did tell me that you had played a major role in helping his son and his family here in the United States, and that Bob and son actually offered to adopt three of his children.
Yes.
But he could not allow that to happen because then his cover might have really been blown. Would have thought it was thank you for Takio and other things. And he did, and his son, An Jr., young An, stayed with Mrs. Kaiser, who is Anson's mother-in-law. Anson. Yeah. Well, okay, Anson. Who I haven't talked, I have not spoken to. I will. I'll get to him. Yeah.
I
think he's in New York.
Like so many old friends, I've just fallen out of touch. I talked Bob out of the 11-story window one night.
Woohoo.
He had a lot. Kansas and sitting in a hotel window, ready to go out the window. He called me. We talked for about an hour and a half, and I got him out of the window.
Yeah, Honest told me he was one of the most hot-headed people he ever met, but
yeah.
One he admired the most.
Yeah.
And Honest told me a story that I have to get Bob to corroborate. Actually, you may recall this. It had to do with when, no, it was not, it was after your time, and you were replaced, who replaced you?
Simmons-Fentress.
And then after Simmons-Fentress?
Fentress was the German
right.
from Paris.
I've got it right here, but and then
I dislike him so that for what he did out there, that I can't remember his name.
It's right here because I.
He wanted to turn all the employees over to North Vietnamese. In order to keep them away from him. However, this is extreme. Well, I'm reasonably sure that's correct.
It wasn't. I'm thinking of actually Marsh Clark, someone else.
Marsh succeeded.
Right. Because Bob really had. This is where Marsh threw him out. And said, "You see this country, Vietnam? That's mine. You see this other one? That's yours.
Yeah.
I don't want to ever see you back in this country again."
Yeah.
And this was a terrible tension between them.
Marsh was really loved by his people there in Saigon.
Did you know Bob's? I have a whole. I actually, Honest read my writing sample, which is called "The Mystery of Robert Sam Anson's Release." This is what the inscription in Anson's library in his house. This is what the inscription says: "For PXA, who taught me about Vietnam and the true meaning of friendship, to you, the bravest man I have ever met, I owe a debt that can never be repaid. Ha Bin, peace." A personal inscription from An by the author in his book War News. And this is what.
Who's the other?
Anson.
Oh, Anson?
Yeah, Anson. Yeah.
Oh.
So that's what Anson wrote inside the book that is in An's book. And on that. But my writing sample, this book's under contract with HarperCollins. And when I submitted it, I wrote a 30-page sample on just what An had told me about Anson's release and what he really did, and the true story about what happened, which Anson doesn't even know.
Yeah, no, I'm sure he does.
And associated with that, and the way we got into this was, An told me the story. It was before Time moved in. It was when Before Time moved into the Continental. They were somewhere else. They had another small office somewhere. And Anson, he complained about the fact that Time was the Time Bureau.
Yeah. We didn't even have a bureau before.
The Time office had a large American flag, but no Vietnamese flag. Hanging right when you came in, and Bob went to the Vietnamese and said, "This is outrageous, and that this is not a government office building. This is a newspaper. Why do you let them have this big American flag here and no Republic of Vietnam flag?"
Right.
And then he raised it with Time, and finally, eventually, there were two flags that were allowed to hang. And this is when François Anson first met Bob, and he said he really admired Bob because Bob had a passion.
Yes, he did.
Real sort of commitment and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
You knew Marsh Clark, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Now a tough defense. Now the criticism I hear of Marsh is that, and I can't. Obviously he's gone. I can't interview him. Which is that he was so pro-war that it did influence us.
A lot about And Marshall all but gave over. Well, he made it clear that he wanted a far greater representation of the official line, you know, in the official American line than in the previous reporting.
Did Luce ever say this is what he wanted, or did this come from the top? That is, did Luce or someone just pass it,
well,
it down?
Not quite, but there was never any doubt about how he felt. For instance, I had him out to, he visited in Saigon, and so two dinners for him, and one of them was, had the Australian ambassador, Australian director of intelligence, New Zealand ambassador, and his director of intelligence, let's see, who else? Who was station chief there then? The station chief of the CIA. And so we had a long dinner. And Luce kept saying, well, how are things going? And he kept getting bleaker and bleaker and bleaker answers. And finally, the Australian ambassador got exasperated with Luce, and he said, what would you suggest, Mr. Luce? Luce said, appoint an American proconsul and we can finish this in a year. Oh, man. So I was walking him back to the hotel that night to his room, and I said, what'd you think of the dinner, Harry? What'd you think of our guests? He said, bunch of losers. So, that, you know, that's where Luce stood.
That's great.
He couldn't conceive of the idea that somebody actually would beat us. It just was incomprehensible to him. Bunch of losers.
So I think I'll wrap up by just asking you, what haven't I asked you that you think I should? I said, my last question is, what do you think I really should have asked you, or what do you know that you haven't told me?
Yeah, that's, I used to, who was it? Some source I had somewhere at some time, used to, I'd go in and see him, sit down and say, what do you want to know? Oh, that puts me off. I think we've covered it pretty well, Larry.
Okay.
Again, what I'm so anxious to do is provide a perspective of a context for the story of On. And so far, nobody's really done that. Now, you know, the point I tried to make over and over and over again about On is that first, you're going to have to grant me this, that he was an intelligent, dedicated Vietnamese. He loved this country. He wanted to do what was best for it. Now, his choice may not have been my choice. It may have been or maybe not. I don't know about that. But the ideology doesn't even concern me. He was doing what he thought was best for his country. How can you criticize that?
But
you just, what is there wrong with that?
You know what I didn't ask you then, which was, and that's a good question, is what do you make of the fact that he loves Americans so much and loves America so much? That is, he really does, the article, the title of that New Yorker article is The Spy Who Loved Us, but On really does have a genuine love and admiration for Americans.
Well,
how do you explain that?
Well, because...
How do you see it?
The lesser part of it was he came to love and respect journalism as practiced in America during his college years and his internship at the Sacramento Bee. And that's the lesser part. The second part is that he became a devout follower of and a supporter lover of democracy while he was here. And those two things combined made him think Americans were pretty damn good people. That's where it all rested. And what he wanted to do was bring that to bear for his country. That's all he was trying to do. Now, you know, the critics will say, well, why did he pick communism for then? Why not? Communism was losing, was winning.
Yeah. Actually, I've asked him this question. His answer to me is always the same, and I believe it comes right from his heart, which is that he never, when he joined the Viet Minh, and when he became a spy, and when he was doing all this in the early 60s, when you were there, this was for him just about the fact that the Japanese, the French, and the Americans didn't belong in his country.
Exactly.
This was a problem for the Vietnamese to set up for themselves.
Right.
And that he never thought in 1975 that this kind of butchery and savagery that would direct the North, punish the South, but also look at what happened to the Viet Cong. They were destroyed.
Wiped out.
He never thought that would happen.
No.
And then when he was sent to re-education, he said to me, Larry, I want you to put this in the book. He doesn't call me Larry, actually. He calls me Professor. And he says, please put into your book that I was sitting in Hanoi reading. It wasn't, and he always says the same thing, it really wasn't re-education, forced labor. It was re-education of the mind.
Yeah.
I had to read all of these communist, all the great Russian, I mean, winks, all the great Russian thinkers, all the things that I hadn't read in 20 years of living with the Americans.
Yeah.
So I had to be brought up to date on the leading economic theories of the socialists and Marxists, etc. And I sat there at night saying to myself, this is the first time I've lived in a communist country.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what have I done?
And on saw Ho Chi Minh as the perfect carrier of what it was he believed in.
Had so many people.
You know, he was. I don't think communist ideology as such meant anything else. It was just that was the way to change things.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Well, that's wonderful. I'll stop. And
that's all right, Larry.
What I wanted to do also was, An has asked me to. I'm going to see Ann on all of next week, every day.
Yeah.
And he asked me to take a picture of you, which I will do.
All right.
And then of us together, too. And I'll carry you this thing for you.
And
I want to give you my book, and I want to stay in touch, and I'm going to go up and look at your papers. And this that's who I am, so you'll have that.
All right, all right.
I wanted to ask you a question here. This, I think, I know you, Chaplin's room was this one you're saying right there?
Yeah.
He had a terrace, and I don't know if the terrace is still there.
Well, this is his room.
And were you up there for those dinners when Ann and he would be there?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
No, this was his room right here. I used to use it every now and then.
Okay. All right, that's it. And you're, and the time office itself
is
was
back
there?
Back here. Right
okay.
There.
All right.
I don't know where Bob was talking about the flags. We never had any flags up.
I will find out exactly, and I'll let you know.
What he was talking about.
Okay. All right. Let me sign my
book. We spent most of our time watching the little guys climb up the pole and tap our wires. Just come and do it in the daylight.
And is there anything in here that you wanted to tell me about, or
you're gonna read it? I'll just give it to you to read.
Okay, and you want me to give it to Ann,
yeah,
right?
Give it to Ann.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll tell him that there was a, somewhere there was a type.
Somewhere there was a type copy. I'm not sure you can read that. I'm not sure I can read it.
He'll be able to read it and sign this. This is my book called No Peace, No Honor: Nixon, Kissinger, the Betrayal in Vietnam.
Lord, I'm glad you did that. That thesis. I've said for years, how I was back in time to cover the Nixon campaign. You remember the secret plan
yeah.
for peace in Vietnam? Yeah, think out.
Yeah.
That's all it was.
Yeah.
Think out, get out. Let it fall as it may.
I had a lot of new information in this book. It's now been in paperback. Simon & Schuster published it, and it's been translated into Vietnamese now. And in Vietnam, on the black market, it's one of the most sought-after books.
Oh, that's great.
It's a funny story about all of that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
And Marvin Kalb and
yeah.
Cy Hirsch gave me some good blurbs,
yeah.
and it was and Stanley.
Yeah.
Stanley's blurb is hilarious. In his carefully researched, authoritative, and highly readable book, Larry Berman unravels for the first time the tawdry endgame in Vietnam. It might be said of Nixon and Kissinger, as Tacitus said of the Peloponnesian War, they made a wasteland and called it peace.
Holy that's it. Oh, God, I'm glad to hear that expression is funny. I've been promising myself to sit down and find somewhere I could write this for someone, but I've never done it. But that's all it was. It was a plain think-out. Nixon was another president with whom I had many, many, many differences.
I believe today is August 3rd. Is it June? Well, I can never tell. I'm on vacation.
He, when he ran against Helen Gehagen Douglas, I covered the campaign for a little bit, and I went out one day to meet him and Pat when they start out the day. I went out to their house in Whittier. And so he grumpily greeted me at the door at the appointed time of 7 and brought me into the little living room, sat me down, and he went off to get dressed. And during the time I was sitting there, he called her a fucking dumb bitch, a slut, just totally obscene, in a loud voice, and repeated over and over and over again. And he came out, glared at me, and said, I suppose you're going to put all that in the magazine. I said, no, I'm not going to put it in the magazine. He said, oh, why? I said, I'm in your home. I'm not going to do that. Oh, bullshit, he said. Yeah, that's the kind of guy he was.
And this is before he was drinking, right?
Yeah, this is before he was drinking.
Yeah.
He's a bad man. You know what? He had the potential to be a great president.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and had a great potential to be a great president, but he was a bad human being. When he lost Pat Brown, came back to Los Angeles. It was a new subdivision, the development anyway, Beverly Estates. And the houses in Beverly Estates at that time were selling for $350,000. Like $2 million now, and so Nixon bought a house in Beverly Hills. We checked and he got it for $125,000. So we ran the story, and he called. He said, "Why the hell did you do that?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was pretty notable, Dick, that you get a price at that, you get that kind of price." He said, "All I did was drive a hard bargain."
Well, I've been listening to the tapes.
Yeah.
The tapes after he's been drinking in the evening, where he's
yeah.
talking in
yeah.
the room. I'm not offended by any language,
yeah.
but his use of language with derogatory statements towards blacks,
yeah.
Jews,
yeah. Yeah.
and women,
right.
It crosses. And this is a leader of the free world.
Yeah.
Across the
yeah.
line, it just shows you a side of a man
yeah.
that's just
he was, again, the sum up, he was a bad human being.
Well, you cut through. I want to look at your pictures for a second.
Oh.
Okay, this is I have not seen that picture, but I recognize you from Zip Grant's photos that
yeah.
Zip uses that on the web. He's got a couple of photographs of you.
Yeah.
And one of your wife standing on the roof of the caravel. You've seen that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, you lived a long time for a guy with a heart murmur. I'm sure people have, you know, I'm sure people have told you
yeah,
this.
Yeah. still getting warnings. Who are those folks? Do you know any of them?
This is Dan Coggan, this is Jim Wilde, and that's Nguyen Duy Dung, our office manager. You know, I have no idea what the circumstance was.
I'm guessing that someone has just arrived.
Yeah, well, it's roses, so. I was telling you about Jim Wilde.
Yeah. I've got some great pictures on it, some refugee camps that people have given me. That's very similar.
What was this? I don't remember what this was. Oh. Obviously, interrogation of VC. Somewhere. I don't remember where.
Here, what I'll do is I'll going to go up. So I want to write down your papers are at the University
of Nevada, Reno.
Of Nevada, it's easy for me to get to. And we'll go up there and gonna look. I have to get a look at their holdings. I'll let you know if I find anything. And this I'll give to Ann.
Fired, huh?
Yeah, you
look at
tired.
That bunch of alert correspondents.
Okay. What I'll do with this is I will hand deliver it to Ann on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I'll say hello to his son. I'm also interviewing, you know, it's very Ann's roommate at North Carolina. When he was an undergraduate,
he's
now a professor of history and my friend at the University of California, Riverside.
Oh, be fair.
And he speaks fluent Vietnamese. He's an American, Caucasian, who married a Vietnamese woman.
Uh-huh.
And he's just fluent in Vietnamese. And both An and Young An like this, his name is David Biggs, very much. Well, David is in Vietnam. He arrived in Saigon 3 days ago. And so David, myself, and Young An are all going to go out to dinner together.
That's great. That's great.
And we're also going to see, they're going to let me do my work during the day.
Is An beginning to tire of the long progression of Americans calling on him or not?
He'll never tire of that.
Yeah.
The problem is that he has had to say no to a lot of people because of his health right now.
Yeah.
I'm one of the only people he really, his wife has agreed to,
She's still running things.
She's still running things, but you know, did I tell you the story about his coffin? Have I told you this story yet?
No.
I didn't bring this picture with me, but it appeared in the newspaper.
Yeah.
And, it's a picture of Ann in the hospital with tubes and wires running into him.
Yeah.
And my student translated it for me. And the translation I got was that he is near death.
Yeah.
This was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it then came to me that he had died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
False story.
I heard the same thing.
False story.
Heard the same thing.
Well, I guess he was so close to death, and the story was accurate that because the story basically said François Ann, a hero of the revolution, nearing the end or whatever, is now in the military revolution hospital number 38 or whatever. It doesn't look like he's getting out. Anyway, and his wife went through all of his drawers and everything, and took anything that she thought was important and put it in his casket so that when he was buried, he would be buried with his secrets.
Sure.
So he lived, right? And so now he's come home and he can't find anything. And he took me in the back to show me what she had done. And he says, and he has no energy. So he says, you know, I'm going to die sooner rather than later. And, you know,
what's done is done. She's made a mess of things. So he goes into the coffin and takes things out from me as we're going through this.
Still got that sly sense of humor.
Oh, yes. You know, and there's three people that he's asked me. You know, the way I really got in contact with you was through him, because he gave me your phone. He opened up his book and he said, "Yeah, right here." And he goes, "We really need to speak to him," you know.
Yeah.
And that was good. His son just, you know, you spoke to him. You know how they feel.
He said his son was furious because he called three times and got the wrong number every time, and therefore he wanted his son to do it.
Yeah. Well, on apparently. You know, his young son, young An, refuses to join the Communist Party.
Yeah,
and this has created a cap for him,
uh-huh.
even though he is in Vietnam now working for the foreign ministry.
He's a senior guy in Saigon.
Right.
As a foreign minister.
Right, right.
I don't know what the title is. But
he'll never be able to go to that next level unless he became
a
party member, and he won't join the party, which is good. And he's so bright. You know, I don't even think they'll let him come to America anymore. On that. And by the way, that quotation of yours that appears in every book that you, anytime anyone reads a quotation from you about On, you are quoted, and I'm assuming it was accurate, where you said, "I don't blame him if 500,000 Vietnamese invaded my country."
Exactly.
I was you did say that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I will handle
it. Well, tell the little old ladies here when they get angry about the Iraqis not welcoming us with open arms. How would you feel if you looked outside and saw 400,000 Iraqi soldiers out there? And the answer every time is the same. That's different. Okay.
If I find anything in Bob Shapling's papers or in your papers, I will let you know immediately.
All right.
And if you have any, if in the middle of the night you start dreaming about this and you have a great idea, let me know.
Okay.
And
I will.
But
what I will do, if I dream about it, is create a problem. And all night long I solve problems. You know, let's see now. I can't do it that way. Better do this.
Well, I've got a year and a half, so I'm going to have plenty of time. And I'd like to take a couple of pictures, if you don't mind, and I'll turn this off.